It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The introduction of fentanyl into the street drug supply has made it almost impossible for opioid users to know what they're taking.
The Drug Enforcement Administration says that last year it seized more than 80 million counterfeit pills made to look like a real prescription, but that contain an unknown, unregulated amount of fentanyl, which can take just 2 milligrams to kill someone.
In Wisconsin, it was one of these pills that killed a Brown County youth, and it was purchased from another teenager in that county who has since been charged with homicide.
A new ProPublica report tells their story and digs into ways that the legal and healthcare systems are falling short for teens when it comes to opioids. Lizzie Presser is a reporter at ProPublica covering health and healthcare policy. Her article is called Malia and Jack, A Story of Teens and Fentanyl. Lizzie, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Can you briefly tell us about, first of all, Jack McDonough, who sadly dies after dealing with addiction and these fentanyl pills showing up at schools?
Of course. So Jack McDonough grew up in De Pere, Wisconsin, just outside of Green Bay. He grew up with his mother and was doing pretty well as a kid at school. He went to Southwest High School in Green Bay. He struggled academically and had low self-esteem, but otherwise had a great group of friends. He didn't do drugs. He smoked weed occasionally. And at the age of 17, he was introduced to Percocets, is what they were called at the time. And he learned to smoke them off of tinfoil. He soon learned that instead of Percocet, he was actually smoking fentanyl. But by that time, he was addicted. So within a couple of months, he really needed one a day or else he was going to be sick. And his mom caught on. She got a sense of what was going on. She saw him rapidly losing weight. She saw ash marks in her car. She saw pieces of tinfoil around the house or straws. She didn't know these were signs of a counterfeit pill problem, but she knew something was up and she looked for help and was really struggling to find it at school and in the community. Eventually, she found out that her son was smoking so-called Percocets and got him into a rehab. But even the rehab wasn't able to help him. They didn't test his urine for fentanyl, and they didn't offer him the first-line treatment that's recommended for teenagers with an opioid use disorder called buprenorphine. It's a long-acting opioid that will protect against overdose and pull back cravings and withdrawal symptoms. So Jack returned to Green Bay at the age of 18, and logged into his girlfriend's Facebook and bought a pill from Malia Sotelo, a 15-year-old who was selling pills at the time. It was the first time he had bought from her. He bought a single pill. He went back to his grandparents where he was living. He smoked that pill, and the following morning, he had died.
And Malia, who he had bought that pill from at 15, selling these illegal counterfeit drugs, tell us her story and how that ended up converging.
Malia grew up the fourth of five sisters with a single mother who had an opioid addiction. In some ways, she was also a child of the opioid crisis. Her mom was unable to parent well. She had serious mental health issues that were going untreated. She turned their home into a kind of trap house where users and dealers were coming by all the time. So Malia grew up around drugs and around the business of drugs. When her mom was no longer fit to parent, one of her older sisters took her in, and her older sister, Mariana, had found that selling drugs was a way to support herself when her mother couldn't. And so Mariana was selling weed, and then she was selling so-called Percocets. So at the age of 15, Malia was exposed to this lifestyle. And once Mariana was arrested and federally indicted for dealing in fentanyl-laced Percocets, her clients started calling Malia asking where they could buy these pills. And Malia saw an opportunity to make some money for her and her younger sister, who she was really charged with taking care of. And she began to sell these fentanyl-laced pills. When I say fentanyl-laced pills, I think it's a bit of a misnomer.
Right.
These aren't fentanyl-laced pills. These pills are just fentanyl and filler. There is no oxycodone or acetaminophen in them. She was selling for several months and making very good money. And after a while, the drug task force caught on They did a controlled buy. They confirmed that she was selling fentanyl, and they did not arrest her. They decided they would wait to build a case. And 3 days later, she sold a pill to Jack, and Jack overdosed and died. Emilio was then charged with homicide.
We were talking about Wisconsin teens, the opioid crisis, and fentanyl pills with Lizzie Presser, health and healthcare policy reporter at ProPublica. You go much deeper into their stories in your piece. But a theme that comes out again and again, Lizzie, is so many points where different systems failed both of these teens. And I want to start with that one that you just mentioned, that Jack's mom really was focused on. The idea that, okay, law enforcement knew that she was selling these fentanyl pills, not fentanyl laced, as you say, but fentanyl pills, and didn't move in and arrest her at the time. Can you talk about that decision and what went into it?
I think there are two parts of this that we need to kind of break apart. The first is that it really is the bread and butter of these proactive narcotics investigations to build a case against someone. So to bring in a controlled and an informant, or for a police officer to go undercover themselves, to make a buy, and then to see if you can surveil and see that this is a habit, not a single purchase, right? So that has long been the process by which these cops operate. When it comes to fentanyl, it doesn't seem as if there has been much reckoning with that process when we know that we are dealing with a far more lethal drug than we have in the past 20 years. So that's one question. Why are we, as a society, not questioning these practices when police are finding folks who are selling what they deem a poison on the street and not doing anything about it? Surely if they found a kid with a gun they shouldn't have had, they would arrest that child immediately and not wait to build a bigger case, right? So that's, I think, the first part of this. The second is that Melia was 15 years old. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a misconception in this country that we think about kids differently from adults. In the legal system, when in fact, in many parts of the judicial system, we do not. So sure, in sentencing, we have seen major reform when it comes to children, because the Supreme Court has ruled again and again that children are not little adults. They don't understand what they're doing in the same way. They can't compute consequences in the same way. And that has all been decided based on a large and growing body of evidence on brain science and neurology. This is not being absorbed by law enforcement. And so what we are finding with the Brown County Drug Task Force, but truly with police forces across the country, is very little policy around what to do when you encounter a minor who is a suspect, how to treat them differently from how you might treat an adult.
Another failure goes way back further with Melia. You talked about her background growing up in a drug household, basically various points of intervention where child services and other agencies might have come in contact, never anything that would have steered her in another path. Can you talk about that a little?
This is a pretty disturbing finding because over the course of Melia's childhood, there were at least 20 referrals to Child Protective Services that were referencing drug use, neglect, no food in the house, sexual abuse to the kids, physical abuse. And over again, Child Protective Services closed the cases. And this was in large part because their mother just refused to participate. And according to Wisconsin statute, you can't identify a mistreater, a maltreater in the Child Protective Services system unless you can interview that person or find a police report. But because Melia's mother refused to participate, they had nowhere to go with the cases, and they closed case after case. So Melia and her sisters were left living with a very dangerous mother for most of their childhoods.
Then on Jack's side, his mother, Carrie, as you said, recognized the problem. At some points, Jack even recognized the problem. You share a heartbreaking letter that Jack writes to his mom. Services very hard for his mom, Carrie, to find when he finds them, as you said, not really giving him the tools he need. What was missing?
Well, first off, very few doctors around the country and in Wisconsin provide buprenorphine, this drug that I've mentioned, which is the first line recommended treatment for teenagers with an opioid use disorder, to minors. There's a major lag in our country's ability to ramp up these services for teens, given how rapidly fentanyl has entered the drug supply. But on top of that, if you look more specifically at just outpatient or inpatient rehabilitation centers, they just don't exist for kids like Jack. So Carrie called SAMHSA, the most comprehensive national resource hotline in the country. It's the federal hotline that's supposed to point you to where to go. And they pointed her to an organization, Libertas, in Brown County, whose inpatient services for teens were actually closed and who didn't provide the gold standard treatment for teenagers. She ended up finding a rehab in Minnesota, and she was only lucky enough to do that because she could afford to pay out of pocket $1,000 a week for 4 weeks. Most people can't do that. And even there, which this is one of 39 rehabs in this country that offer buprenorphine to kids. It's a tiny, tiny fraction. And even there, they didn't give Jack the care that he needed, the treatment that he needed. And he returned to Green Bay, still dependent and addicted to fentanyl. On top of all of this, there was the school. And Carrie kept turning to the school and asking for help. And she says she was brushed off. And these schools are under-resourced, right? They don't have the funding and the ability and even the referral pathways for these kids. But that's the first place that a lot of parents are going to go, and those schools aren't helping these parents.
Just briefly in our last half a minute, Lizzie, why was it important to you to put a face on what we might just see statistics about?
I think ultimately this is exactly what you were saying. It is a story about how unwilling as a society we have been to look directly at addiction, and particularly when it comes to minors. We hear lots of stories of kids dying spontaneously from a fentanyl-laced pill, which suggests that this is a rare exposure to fentanyl. In my reporting, I found something quite different. There are hundreds of thousands of kids who are addicted to opioids and are struggling to find the treatment that they need. They want the treatment. Their parents want the treatment. But we as a country have not built the infrastructure to supply those kinds of services to these kids. And that's something that we're ignoring and need to be paying attention to.
Lizzie, thanks for sharing your work with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Lizzie Presser, reporter at ProPublica. She covers health and healthcare policy. Her story about a Wisconsin teen who passed away because of fentanyl and the person who sold it to him. It's called Malia and Jack, a story of teens and fentanyl. Find it at ProPublica.org.